We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Law at UCLA Law School, Adam Winkler, author of We the Corporations, How Corporations Won Their Civil Rights. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So let's go back. Well, I guess let's start with our terms. I mean, what exactly is a corporation and do they exist in nature?
Yeah, I mean, I guess certainly in the God did not create man, woman, the heavens and the earth, and the corporation in the those earliest days. But corporations have been with us for a long time. The corporation has been used as a way of gathering up resources to create an enterprise, a business, or other kind of entity. Ever since 300 years before the birth of Christ in ancient Rome. And the form has been with us ever since. But over the last 200 or 300 years, we've seen the real rise of the successful business corporation. And my book traces how that business corporation came to win constitutional rights on just like women and minorities in America.
I mean, that is really, I mean, the rub here, right, is not the question of how the construction of corporations as much as they have been layering on, I guess, certain abilities and capacities and rights over the course of our country's development. What was, I mean, do we have a sense of how corporations were perceived or what rights corporations were perceived to have during the era that the Constitution or in the process of the Constitution being drawn up? In other words, did our framers have a notion of how of what rights a corporation would have?
You know, there's no evidence that the framers even entertained the idea that the Constitution would protect corporations the way it protects ordinary individuals and citizens. There was no mention of corporations in the ratifying debates or any discussion of the rights of corporations at the Philadelphia Convention. But it didn't take long for corporations to seek those rights. The first Supreme Court case on whether corporations were protected by the Constitution was decided in 1809. To put that in some perspective, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans wasn't decided until 1857. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of women wasn't decided until 1873. A half century before that, corporations are in the Supreme Court winning constitutional protections.
I want to talk about that 1809 case just briefly, which involved a bank's right and sort of its jurisdiction. But before we get there, what was the corporation? Why, in the context of American society, what was the corporation supposed to afford to those people who would register one if it wasn't this whole suite of rights that it has developed over the years?
Well, the truth is the corporation was always invented from the very earliest days to exercise some rights, mostly a property right. People wanted to be able to pool their resources, put them into one business or enterprise, and have that business or enterprise be able to carry on over time, even if the particular people who had purchased shares might pass on or might sell their shares to other people. That was the whole idea, that rights would stay on and be continued on. And if you go back to 1757, you can read Blackstone, the influential English commentator on the law, who wrote in his commentaries that corporations were artificial persons that existed to exercise property rights.
All right, and so I want to sort of hit some of the highlights of the cases and this sort of like long journey in which the corporation has been able to sort of grow its rights under the Constitution. But I want to just start with the sort of the general framework, because there's really two ways that you get there, right? And I think today the idea of corporations are not people is sort of the rallying cry that we have heard, particularly in the wake of Citizens United. But you argue that the real problem here is that not so much that corporations are perceived to have the rights of people, but rather the veil between corporations and the individuals who make them up has become too permeable in some ways.
That's right. I think, you know, we think that corporate personhood is really the source of Citizens United and the problems of corporate power in America. But the story is a little bit more nuanced. When you go back through the history, you find that the Supreme Court doesn't often say that corporations are people. And when it does, not much turns on it. In fact, what's happened is that the court usually says corporations have rights because the people who form the corporation have rights. And that the idea is that the corporation is just a stand-in or a pass-through for the rights of the members. And well, what I talk about in my book is that this is actually in derogation contrary to the principle of corporate personhood. Because corporate personhood, as understood in corporate law, and it's a very well-established legal principle, is that corporations are wholly separate entities in the eyes of the law, so totally, wholly different and distinct and apart from the shareholders or the people who form the corporation. In fact, what the Supreme Court has done is usually looked through the corporation, pierced the corporate veil, if you will, and allowed corporations to exercise the rights of its members.
And maybe we should just put a pin in why that is so problematic. But let's go back to that 1809, just to give people a sense of how these rights have been sort of layered upon each other on some level. And this was just simply a question of that first major corporate rights case was simply a question of where the case could be heard.
That's right. The case involved the Bank of the United States, which is famous for giving us a well-known rap battle in Hamilton the musical, and also gave us the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations. After Jeffersonians in Georgia imposed a tax on the bank wanted to sue in federal court. It didn't want to sue in state court, have to sue in Georgia state court where the law would likely be upheld. They wanted to sue in federal court, and the Constitution provides that citizens do have a right to sue in federal court if they sue citizens of other states. And even though the provision of the Constitution only refers to the rights of citizens, the bank claimed that it was entitled to that right too, and indeed the Supreme Court ultimately agreed.
Okay, and so, and again, was that a situation, I mean, just sort of applying that that function that we had talked about just earlier, was that a function of seeing the corporation as having the same rights as a person, or rather that the individuals who made up that corporation sort of, you know, could exercise this one right at that time?
No, what the court said in that case was that essentially the parties to the case weren't really the corporations involved. There wasn't the corporation involved, but actually its own members. And again, like as I mentioned earlier, in the idea of corporate personhood, as it's really embedded in the law, is that a corporation is its own independent entity in the eyes of the law, with whole rights wholly separate and distinct from the rights and duties of its members. That's why if you slip and fall in a Starbucks today, you can't sue the individual shareholders. You can't sue the CEO or the employees. You have to sue the corporation itself, because it is a separate legal person with its own identity in the eyes of the law and its own legal responsibilities.
I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself, but I can't help it. I mean, isn't that's the major dilemma, right? Or a problem, I think it's fair to say, is that there are certain rights that the corporation has that's almost sort of, I don't want to say borrowing, but is bequeathed to them because of the individuals. But it doesn't have the same sort of, I guess, duties or restrictions that also come with those individuals have. Is that the central issue here?
Well, I think that is right. I think that one of the problems is that we've given corporations more and more of the rights of citizens, but they don't really have the responsibility of citizens. And indeed, you know, they're fundamentally not citizens. You know, corporations are legally obligated to pursue the interests of the corporation. They operate under a very strict legal mandate to put the interests of the corporation, generally interpreted to mean in the long term the interests of shareholders, before anything else. And, you know, true citizens get to choose what their values will be and what they will pursue and what they will prioritize. The corporation doesn't quite have that same freedom, so it's not quite a citizen.
Okay, so let's move forward and talk to us about this case of Dartmouth College in 1819 and what that did in the context of this, I guess, body of law.
The Dartmouth College case is a very important case in this history because before the Dartmouth College case, corporations had always been a little bit private and a little bit public. They could only be formed by the government, and the government would only form them when a group of private individuals wanted to pursue a project that had a public purpose. And it was a requirement to form a corporation that you had to serve the public broadly. And the Dartmouth College case is a case where the Supreme Court says, in America, corporations will be private entities. They'll be like individuals, not like government agencies. And because they're like individuals, they have the rights of individuals, and they can challenge government action, and government's power over them was limited. And that Dartmouth College case was really a very important turning point for the American corporation. And in its wake, we see a huge rise in the number of corporations and the spread of American corporate capitalism.
Okay, and so let's jump up to the 1880s, where there's a series of cases that center around the Southern Pacific Railroad, and this is where the they are established, and maybe some would argue the sort of the bastardization in some ways of the 14th Amendment. Tell us about those cases and Roscoe Conkling, is that I believe that is his name.
It's really one of the most remarkable stories in the history of American constitutional law, which is the story of how corporations won equal rights under the 14th Amendment. That provision had been adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves. But the Southern Pacific Railroad Company and its illustrious lawyer, Roscoe Conkling, went to the Supreme Court and argued that the 14th Amendment was also written to protect business corporations. Conkling had special credibility with the justices. He had been nominated and confirmed to sit on the Supreme Court himself, turning the seat down. He had been one of the drafters of the 14th Amendment when he had been a young congressman. So when he said the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to protect business corporation, it had a lot of weight with the justices. It turns out, though, that we now know, historians have gone back and looked at the evidence and discovered that Roscoe Conkling likely had lied to the Supreme Court about the history of the 14th Amendment.
This story is so, I just want to just take a moment for people to absorb this because it is so so consequential and nuts that the guy just basically he just lied in terms of what the intent was behind this behind the amendment.
That's right. And the case then took even a more bizarre turn, which is eventually the Supreme Court ruled on the Southern Pacific cases, but didn't rule on the constitutional question, didn't address whether corporations have rights under the 14th Amendment. But the court's reporter of decisions, a bureaucrat who puts together the official published versions of the opinions in official volumes, wrote a summary of the Southern Pacific case and published it in the official volume, saying that the court had decided that corporations had equal rights under the 14th Amendment. And in the years to come, that case would be cited over and over again by the Supreme Court and other courts for the proposition that corporations have rights under the 14th Amendment, a proposition that the case itself did not endorse.
Now, okay, so that guy was a guy named, I think it was J.C. Bancroft Davis, if I'm not mistaken. And so the court initially, when Conkling came and argued that and had this sort of, I guess, this prestige and this imprimatur of having been at the very least given the option of being on the Supreme Court and the supposed credibility that comes with having been involved in the drafting of the 14th Amendment. Did the Supreme Court believe him? Like, I mean, the fact that they didn't, he didn't seem to convince the court on that issue. Was that an indication of the court just sort of saying, like, this guy's a little bit dubious, or did they just not feel it was necessary to rule on that? I mean, what was behind the fact that there was even that opportunity for Davis, the court reporter, the guy who was basically just in charge of, you know, summarizing, synopsizing in some ways, for lack of a better term, the cases. I mean, what? Why didn't they rule on that part of it?
Well, we don't know exactly why the Supreme Court didn't rule on it. That's been a subject of some historical speculation. One possibility, though, is that Roscoe Conkling's fraud might have been uncovered by the justices, and they might have been uncomfortable with his argument. Yet, nonetheless, the justices themselves were ideologically or philosophically inclined to extend rights to corporations. And in the years that followed, they would use the Southern Pacific case as really an excuse to extend constitutional protections to businesses, because that fit the worldview of the justices coming up in a period in the court's history known as the Lochner era, roughly 1890 to 1937, a period of time in which the court broadly read the 14th Amendment to protect businesses, even while the Supreme Court refused to read the 14th Amendment broadly to protect African Americans, the intended beneficiaries of the 14th Amendment.
Was there any time over the court's history where any of the clerks or the justices said, hey, wait a second, I went back and I read the actual decisions in these series of cases from the Southern Pacific Railroads, and this court reporter essentially was mistaken? Or, I mean, was it ever determined why Davis wrote that, and did anybody on the court ever say, hey, wait a second, this is not the law, this was just a mistake?
Well, we don't exactly know why Bancroft Davis included this inaccurate summary. Some people have noted in the speculation that he himself was the former president of the Newburgh and New York Railway Company, so perhaps he had some self-interest. We don't really know. But we do know that there was one justice, and really only one justice in the years and decades to come, who would take on the idea that corporations had rights under the 14th Amendment. And that was a justice by the name of Hugo Black, who was one of the longest-serving justices over the course of the 20th century, appointed in the late 1930s and served until, I think, the early 1970s, late 1960s. Black was an interesting character. He was a real corporate reformer who was opposed to corporate business. He was sort of a Southern populist. In fact, when he joined the Supreme Court, it was came out that he had been a former member of the KKK. But Hugo Black was an interesting person, and by the time he died, the New York Times' obituary called him one of the great advocates for civil rights and civil liberties in American history, because he had been such a consistent vote on the Supreme Court for racial justice.
But getting back to Black's perspective on anti-corporate, his anti-corporate perspective, that is, he's really in the history of the court in that regard. Maybe I guess you could also put Brandeis in there, right, on some level. But by and large, the history of the Supreme Court has been very corporate friendly, regardless of who appointed the justices or, you know, who is considered a liberal or conservative.
That's right. One of the things we find over the course of American history is that while we think about the court in terms of liberal or conservative, one thing that unites the justices over time has been a real willingness to side with business and to expansively read the Constitution to benefit and to privilege business interests. And that's been on the right and on the left. And it's been surprising bedfellows. It turns out that it was often conservative courts like the Lochner era court that first drew some of the first boundaries on the rights of corporations, saying that they were entitled to property rights, but not liberty rights, rights associated with personal conscience or political freedom. And it was, oddly enough, some of the liberal courts of the New Deal and Warren Court eras of the mid-20th century that expansively read the Constitution to provide new protections for corporations and gave corporations some of their first liberty rights.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about those. The NAACP had a case in the 1950s that did just that, right? Expanded the right of corporations, I guess, to associate. I mean, explain that court that case.
Yeah, well, it happened in a couple of different places. In the New Deal and Warren Court eras, corporations were first extended liberty rights, including the First Amendment freedom of the press in the 1930s in important cases where newspaper corporations were challenging censorship by the likes of Huey Long and others, and won, even though they were corporations, rights of under the First Amendment. And then the NAACP won the freedom of association. And we don't think of the NAACP as a corporation because it's certainly not a business, but it was formed as a corporation. And racists in the South, after Brown versus Board of Education, tried to use its corporate structure as a way of getting at the NAACP and putting it out of business, if you will, stopping it from litigating cases down south. The NAACP won a case in the Supreme Court establishing that corporations do have a right of freedom of association, and at least nonprofit corporations had a right to protect the identity of their members. That case would later be used as precedent by business corporations to protect their own rights and to expand their own freedom of association.
Speak about Ralph Nader's role in expanding the rights of corporations, because we don't normally. I mean, I think this is the thing that people, that lay people should understand is that the liberal left, I guess, arguments that expanded corporate rights were not. We're of a different ilk, I guess, from a legal perspective, they're not really any more different than a conservative attempts to expand corporate rights. But because it's just the expansion of corporate rights, right? I mean, people, I think it's counterintuitive to us to know that Ralph Nader helped expand corporate rights, it seems to me.
Well, that's right. And there's a lot of sort of these counterintuitive and sort of surprising discoveries in this history. And one of them is Ralph Nader's contribution to corporate rights. And of course, that's not what Ralph Nader was intending to do. In the 1970s, Ralph Nader won a landmark victory in the Supreme Court on behalf of consumers. He was the great consumer rights advocate of the era, and his lawsuit challenged and overturned a Virginia law that restricted the advertising of drug prices. And like I say, Nader in helping the consumers get accurate information. But the Supreme Court adopted his theory, which is known as the listener's rights theory of the First Amendment. That's the idea that the amendment protects speech if it's valuable to listeners, like the consumers Ralph Nader was representing. And that very theory gets used in the court by the Supreme Court in the Citizens United case, where the court says, well, regardless of the identity of the speaker, the corporations here want to fund political speech that's valuable to listeners. And as we said in Ralph Nader's Virginia pharmacy case, the listeners have rights under the First Amendment, even if the corporation itself might not.
Let's talk about Citizens United. But before we do, I mean, because I think there's a lot in Citizens United. And of course, there's a whole litany of cases that lead us to Citizens United. Bellotti coming out of Massachusetts and Buckley v. Vallejo. But in terms of Citizens United, I mean, why don't you characterize that case for us? And then I want you to assess how well Citizens United was adjudicated relative to some of these other cases. Because is it as easy as saying there are certain principles created or developed in specific cases that are then sort of expanded upon or leveraged later? But it seems to me in Citizens United, just even the perception of the facts was a little bit off from the justices. But you characterize Citizens United for us.
Well, Citizens United is, of course, the capstone of this 200-year effort by corporations to win constitutional protections, because corporations won the right, the same right as individuals, to spend their money to influence elections. And once you empower corporations in this way, there's really little to stop them from exercising their power and influence over society in a very powerful way. And that case was odd and unusual. It did represent many of the themes that we've seen in the earlier cases. However, it was different, and the actual litigation itself was an unusual story. It was an unusual bit of judicial activism, if you will. The Supreme Court had been asked to decide one question under the law, and the justices decided, hey, that's not the question we want to really address. We want to take on the question of whether corporations can be stopped from spending their money on elections, which was not the question that was originally posed by the lawyers themselves arguing the case. And the justices decided that they were going to call for a second hearing in the case. And they ended up having two hearings in the case so that the justices could reach out and decide a question that the lawyers themselves hadn't even bothered to ask the court to decide.
How often does that happen?
It's very rare. And what happened in this case is that it was framed around a narrow question about how the applicability of a statute to a documentary movie about Hillary Clinton. And when the justices went behind closed doors, five of the justices decided they wanted to write a bold, aggressive opinion overturning years of campaign finance law restricting corporate money in elections. And the liberal justices raised some hackles, apparently, and objected to this and said this is a violation of our norms. The Supreme Court only addresses questions after they've been briefed and argued before us. And so the conservative justices decided, okay, well, we want briefing and argument. We'll have another hearing, and we'll have briefing and argument. But the fix was already in. The votes had already been cast. That law had already been overturned even before the second oral argument even occurred.
Is the linchpin of that case, what is the linchpin of that case? Is it that money is speech, that is, or is it that you simply, why is it money is speech? I mean, is that more the problem than corporations are people?
Well, there's no doubt that the problem of money in our electoral process is much bigger than just corporate money in elections. And indeed, since Citizens United, we've seen individuals like a Sheldon Adelson, for instance, take much more advantage of Citizens United than corporate entities really have. And there's been an increase in corporate spending, but it hasn't matched the increase in individual spending. So I do think that Citizens United is in some way shorthand for a larger set of campaign finance problems that involve too much money in the political process. I don't think it's quite as simple as money is speech or money isn't speech. You know, if you want to take out an ad on an election-related issue, it's going to cost you money. Like, you're going to spend some money, and if government can stop you from spending any money on election ads, they really can restrict your speech. But there's got to be some way, a balance that we can have that allows people to spend their money, but doesn't necessarily allow corporations that have enormous amassed resources thanks to the corporate form and these special legal privileges to spend their money too.
I mean, maybe we're getting a little off track here, but why is that problematic that you can't spend X amount of dollars on political speech? I mean, why is it that is it just simply the idea of the government dictating what you can spend on a certain product is inappropriate? Is it infringement on your First Amendment rights as opposed
well,
to
I,
go ahead.
You know, many people in the liberal circles I like to hang out in often say to me, well, part of the problem is the idea that money is speech, because money is not speech, and that's the mistake that the Supreme Court has made. And I guess I just disagree with that attitude. I think that it does take money to be able to fund political speech, and if the government stops you from or prohibits you from spending money to advocate for something, then it's really effectively stopping you from speaking. And to take another example, for instance, imagine if the Trump administration passed a law that said you can get an abortion, but you can't spend any money on abortions. that would limit your ability to get an abortion quite significantly.
I think they literally did that yesterday.
They're doing it with Planned Parenthood. And the idea is not that money is abortion, because obviously it isn't, but money is necessary to secure an abortion, to exercise those fundamental rights. Sometimes you need some money, and we should admit that fact and not try to deny it.
But what is the limiting principle here? Because it seems to me, if we're going to argue that that you have the right to spend money in an unfettered fashion, on speech, let's say, or on politics, couldn't one argue that taxation is in some way inhibiting your First Amendment rights, because you're basically limiting what I can spend on politics by some other means?
I guess you could definitely come up with some creative arguments. And certainly the story of my book is a story about how corporations did make very creative, innovative arguments to reinterpret the Constitution, to extend their constitutional protections for them. You need creative arguments to win fundamental rights in the Supreme Court. Every great civil rights movement has had amazing lawyers like Thurgood Marshall or Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And the corporate rights movement has also relied on legendary lawyers like Daniel Webster or Ted Olson or John Quincy Adams, all who argued for the rights of corporations and are the kinds of lawyers who were famous for making the kinds of novel arguments that you suggest.
Where does Hobby Lobby fit in this? Is that another example of sort of that veil between the owners of the corporation, I guess, and the corporation being too porous?
Yeah, Hobby Lobby has one big difference from the cases I talk about mostly in my book, because it's about a federal statute on religious liberty and not about the Constitution. And so my book is mostly about constitutional rights. But Hobby Lobby otherwise is a good embodiment of the principles that we've seen in these corporate rights cases. The Supreme Court, number one, extends a fundamental right to corporations, in this case, religious liberty, that might be thought to be the kind of right only individuals could have. And number two, the court does so not because corporations are people, but because corporations are pass-throughs or corporations are associations of people. And ultimately, the court says that the law at issue in the Hobby Lobby case, a law that required the national chain of craft stores to include birth control in employee health plans, the court said that law was a burden on the religious liberty rights of Hobby Lobby's owners, the Green family. The problem with that idea is that, of course, if someone were to slip and fall in a Hobby Lobby store today, the Green family would be the first ones to say, hey, we're totally separate legal persons with separate legal rights from our corporation. Yet when it came to religious liberty, the Green family wanted to break through that barrier and impose their own religious beliefs on the entity itself.
Are we just waiting? And that dynamic, though, even in the context of constitutional law, right, that's the dynamic that has been going on, is that the corporations are assuming these rights that are given to their owners, but they're not assuming the obligations or the liabilities.
That's absolutely right. And if we think about this, Hobby Lobby case involved a real balance between the religious liberty rights of Hobby Lobby's owners, perhaps, but sort of left out of the equation seems to be the 12 or 13,000 women employees of Hobby Lobby for whom health care is not going to include birth control coverage. When corporations have constitutional rights, often we the people are the victim.
We've talked on this program in various contexts how the extension of First Amendment rights and the adoption or the arguments by corporations that they have them is being used and sort of anticipating its use. And I know you write about this too. The anticipate its use in leveraging other laws. So, for instance, maybe it's limitless in terms of imagination, but where do you anticipate corporations going in terms of like the First Amendment? It seems to me like they're going to use the First Amendment going forward the way that they used the 14th Amendment for a long time. Where do you anticipate that going? And then, like, you know, well, I'll ask you, you know, what do we do about this aside from hope to get a radically different type of justices on the court over the next, well, I don't know. But tell us about the First Amendment.
Well, you're absolutely right about your sense about the First Amendment. Although the First Amendment was invigorated and first imagined to protect outcasts and dissenters, people who were going to be persecuted by the government, in fact, today, about 50% of all First Amendment cases that are brought in the federal courts are brought by corporations and or trade associations that represent corporations. They've really kind of hijacked the First Amendment and are now really the most important litigants in the American First Amendment law. And we're seeing them challenge laws that regulate things like graphic cigarette warnings on tobacco packages, on SEC requirements to disclose the use of conflict minerals, and all sorts of things. A good example is corporation before the Supreme Court this term in one of the biggest, highest profile cases, a Colorado bakery that refused to bake a cake for a same-sex couple. That case, although not thought of in terms of corporate rights, is a case about a business corporation, Masterpiece Cake Shop, and whether it will have to obey Colorado's anti-discrimination laws.
So, what do we do about this? I mean, I mean, in terms of reversing this, of mitigating the ability of corporations, particularly in the context of political speech. I mean, what is there? Is our destiny to, you know, not ever have the ability to control money in politics?
Well, I don't know. I think that what we may well see is a backlash against all this corporate power and corporate influence. And we've seen that before. At the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s, it was a time of enormous corporate political power and corporate economic power in the era of the trusts. And that was a time where we saw people rise up and try to change the Constitution and change the law to limit corporate power and to re-empower ordinary individuals. And we saw it in things like the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, providing for the direct election of senators, an amendment that was designed to fight back against corporate control over state legislatures. And we saw in 1907 the rise of the first campaign finance laws restricting corporate money in elections. And I tell the story about how that law came about and the earliest challenges to that law. Indeed, we have seen in the past people rise up and say we are going to limit corporate power. The question is whether we have that will to do that today.
Well, I mean, the question is the will, but also is the question is the opportunity. Are the mechanisms as available, right? I mean, are you suggesting, what are the mechanisms in which we would deal with this? Let's assume for a moment that there is the will and that there is, what do you think are the, you know, the arrows in the quiver that are available? Is it just simply amendment to the Constitution? It seems to me that statutorily, with this Supreme Court that we have, there's not a lot of room to write, campaign finance reform laws.
You know, you make a very, very good point, and it's true that with the current Supreme Court and without changes in the Supreme Court, we're likely to only see the rights of corporation expand and the rights of corporations' opponents, like consumers and unions and employees, find themselves increasingly on the short end of the stick. So there's no doubt. And the truth is that that's also reminiscent of an earlier era. Back when we tried to limit corporate power around the turn of the century in the era of the trust, the Supreme Court responded by overturning some of those laws and becoming sort of notorious for being so business friendly at the time. So we may be seeing a repeat in that history too. And that's a very significant problem. But I do think that the larger story is the lesson to take from corporations is if corporations can win constitutional protections that are really appropriate for citizens and individuals, then really you should be aggressive and assertive and persistent in your constitutional claims, because you can win the day, even with very novel and imaginative claims.
Do you think that court, there's a potential for court packing? I mean, because Otherwise, it seems to me that, and particularly in the event that Donald Trump has another pick, another bite at that apple for the Supreme Court, I don't know how old you are, but I feel like I'm old enough that I will not see a court that's going to overturn any of this stuff unless there's some type of like court packing scheme. I mean, as far as this being the route to deal with that problem.
Well, you do point out the difficulty of going through the Supreme Court. There is a movement afoot to amend the Constitution that would obviate the need for Supreme Court justices to change their mind or to get new personnel. About 19 states have endorsed a constitutional amendment, a proposed 28th amendment that would say that corporations are not people and don't have any rights under the Constitution. I'm skeptical that this is the right approach to the problem of corporate power. I think it would deny corporations that are not business corporations, including organizations like Planned Parenthood and the Sierra Club and even conservative groups like the NRA, of their fundamental rights too. And so probably is a little bit too overbroad. But we might have a very valid campaign finance reform amendment or a more limited amendment that really targets corporate power in an effective way.
Interesting stuff. I hope we have the opportunity to sort of reverse this stuff. I'm a little bit too cynical, but Professor Adam Winkler, the book is We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.